Good evening and welcome to this KLMJ News special broadcast of A Lesson in Liberty, the signing of the U.S. Constitution, followed by a debate between Democrat Kristi Vilsack and Republican Steve King, candidates for Congress representing Iowa's 4th Congressional District. This program is presented on 104.9 KLMJ and is also being streamed on the World Wide Web at KLMJ.com.
Thank you guys so much for coming. A couple things I just want to tell you. Underneath, it's kind of like an Oprah thing, underneath all of your seats was a bag. Discount cards, we wanted to thank you so much for coming. So hopefully everyone got one underneath your seat. So kind of reach underneath there. You'll see the program. No, you didn't win a car. But you got to be in Greater Franklin County! Yeah! So, a couple things we want to talk about. I think we've told everybody. We want to hear this debate. So, this will be our first warning. Kind of no catcalling, no yelling, no screaming. We want to be able to hear the candidates. We have a limited time for the questions. So, please respect your fellow people here so we can hear what the candidates are saying. It's so wonderful they came here. We can rally some more over at the courthouse. I have it till 10 o'clock, so afterwards you can go over there and let off some steam. But in here, let's hear what they've got to say. Without further ado, a couple other things. Make sure your cell phones are off. Matter of fact, I can do it myself here, so we're all going to turn off our cell phones. I'll be the example. Okay, great. Got mine off. Everybody else got theirs off? All right. Everybody ready? The first thing we're going to do here is have a wonderful session here. And this is titled A Lesson in Liberty. Here we go.
The signing of the Constitution, A Lesson in Liberty. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America. My name is James Wilson. I'm 45 years of age and a lawyer from Pennsylvania. As a signer of the Declaration of Independence, I am proud to say that I am a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. The year is 1787. The location is the State House in Philadelphia, also known as Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence was signed 11 years earlier. The Federal Convention convened on May 14th to revise the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation needed revision because, one, the new government could not tax. Two, they could not control the trade between people. And three, they also were afraid of tyranny. a fear of another king. So there was no one leader. Because the delegations from only two states were at first present, the members adjourned from day to day until a quorum of seven states was obtained on May the 25th. Through discussion and debate, it became clear by mid-June that rather than amend the existing articles, the convention would draft an entirely new frame of government. With the exception of Rhode Island, which refused to participate, the states had originally appointed 70 representatives to the convention, but a number of appointees did not accept or could not attend, leaving 55 delegates who would ultimately craft the Constitution. For 4 months, these 55 delegates in closed session debated and redrafted the articles of the new Constitution for a federal republic. Among the chief points at issue were, 1, how much power to allow the central government? 2, how many representatives in Congress to allow each state? And 3, how these representatives should be elected, directly by the people or by state legislators? To better understand the convention, we need to get to know the delegates. Benjamin Franklin, born in Massachusetts, was a delegate from Pennsylvania. He was 81 years old at the time of the convention. He arrived on May 28th and was present through the signing of the Constitution. Near the end of June, when the convention was in disarray, he suggested prayers be offered every morning before the assembly proceeded in business. He also was known for his Rising Sun speech delivered on September 17th. Convention Secretary William Pierce stated that, quote, "The very heavens obeyed him, and the clouds yield up their lightning to be imprisoned in his rod." He said, "A most extraordinary man, and tells a story in a style more engaging than I have ever heard." It is my pleasure to now introduce the senior delegate from the great state of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson, and welcome all you citizens of this great United States. It is my privilege to share with you who some of those leaders were that helped form this great document that we call our Constitution. As he mentioned, there was 55 delegates, and they met for a great length of time. And so there was many things that occurred during that presence of the forming of the Constitution. One of the leaders that we're all familiar with, George Washington. George was 55 years old at that time and was from the state of Virginia. As you recall, he was a general, and he was elected by the delegates to be the presiding person over the Constitution Convention. General Washington was a very quiet person and said very little during the deliberations until finally towards the end he did make a few comments. However, he was found to be very instrumental in many of the decisions that were made. Another gentleman, William Price from the state of Georgia, was at the convention and kept keynotes and wrote very memorable character sketches of the fellow delegates. However, Mr. Price had to leave in July to attend to business and was not able to return for the signing of the Constitution. Edward Randolph, again one of the younger delegates, 34 from the state of Virginia, was present through the signing of the Constitution, but he did not sign the Constitution. He was best known for introducing and defending the Virginia Plan. George Madison, 62, was also from the state of Virginia. He was present for the signing of the Constitution. However, he did not sign it. He argued that the Constitution inadequately represented the interests of the people and the state. Another delegate from the state of Massachusetts was Elbridge Gerry, 43. He chaired the committee that represented the Connecticut Compromise. As you can tell, there was many different suggestions as to what the different elements of the Constitution were involved. He represented the Connecticut Compromise, but did not think the Constitution provided adequate rights for the individuals and the states. So you can see, so he refused to sign the Constitution. So it was much like us. They didn't all agree on the same characteristics. Another delegate, John Dickinson, was from the state of Delaware. He signed the Constitution, but he argued with Mr. Madison that they were going too far in pushing for proportional representation. Obviously, as you know, we have to date the amount of people determine the delegates known. He's best known for the phrase that said, "Let experience be your guide, reason may mislead us." The last candidate, James Madison Jr., was from Virginia, and he was best known for writing the Virginia Plan and defended the attempt to build a stronger central government. He kept very accurate notes of the convention, and upon his death in 1836, they were open to the public. Many of the characters that we know during that time period were not involved in the Constitutional Convention because of other responsibilities they had, such as Thomas Jefferson. He was abroad. He was our minister to France. John Adams was our minister to Britain, and he was gone. Patrick Henry refused to be involved in the convention because he thought it would lead to a monarchy. And then some of the other candidates like John Hancock and Samuel Adams that were very experienced leaders were involved in their state's activities and were not able to attend. These were some of the candidates that were involved that helped make the document that we know as the Constitution that has allowed to have us this great country we have today.
Thank you, Dr. Franklin.
Thank you.
On the last day of the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin wanted to give a short speech to the convention prior to the signing of the final draft of the Constitution. Being too weak, I, James Wilson, delivered the following, as reported in Madison's notes on the convention for Monday, September 17, 1787. Mr. President, I confess that there are several parts of this Constitution which I do not at present approve, but I am not sure I shall never approve them. For having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions even on important subjects which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. It is therefore that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment and to pay more respect to the judgment of others. Most men indeed, as well as most sects in religion, think themselves in possession of all truth and that wherever others differ from them, it is so far error. Steele, a Protestant in a dedication, tells the Pope that the only difference between our churches in their opinions of the certainty of their doctrines is the Church of Rome is infallible and the Church of England is never wrong. But though many private persons think almost as highly of their own infallibility as of that of their sect, few express it so naturally as a certain French lady who, in dispute with her sister, said, quote, "I don't know how it happens, sister, but I meet with nobody but myself that's always in the right." In these sentiments, sir, I agree to this Constitution with its faults, if there are such, because I think a general government necessary for us, and there is no form of government but what may be a blessing to the people if well administered. And believe farther that this is likely to be well administered for a course of years and can only end in despotism, as other forms have done before it, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other. I doubt, too, whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better constitution. For when you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all their prejudice, their passions, their airs of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. From such an assembly, can a perfect production be expected? It therefore astonishes me, sir, to find this system approaching so near a perfection as it does. And I think it will astonish our enemies, who are waiting with confidence to hear that our councils are confounded like those of the builders of Babel, and that our states are on a point of separation, only to meet hereafter for the purpose of cutting one another's throats. Thus I consent, sir, to this constitution because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best. The opinions I have had of its errors I sacrifice to the public good. I have never whispered a syllable of them abroad. Within these walls they are born, and here they shall die. If every one of us returning to our constituents were to report the objections that he has had to it, and then endeavor to gain partisans to support of them, we might prevent it from generally being received, and therefore lose all salutary effects and great advantages resulting naturally in our favor among foreign nations as well among ourselves, from our real or apparent unanimity. Much of the strength and efficiency of any government in procuring and securing the happiness to the people depends on the general opinion of the goodness of the government, as well as of the wisdom and integrity of its governors. I hope, therefore, for our own sakes, as a part of the people, and for the sake of posterity, we shall act heartily and unanimously in recommending this Constitution, wherever our influence may extend, and turn our future thoughts and endeavors to the means of having it well administered. On the whole, sir, I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of this convention, who may still have objections to it, would, with me, this occasion, doubt a little of his infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name on this instrument. While the last members there, at the back of which a rising sun was painted, Franklin observed to a few members near him that the painters had found it difficult to distinguish in their art a rising or a setting sun.
I have often, and often in my course of this session and the discussion of my hopes and fears on this issue, looked at that symbol in the back of the president's chair without being able to tell, is it a rising sun or is it a setting sun? But now I know at length, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising sun and not a setting sun.
Indeed, it is a rising sun. The Constitution was signed by all the members except delegates Randolph, Mason, and Gary. With no other business, the delegates adjourned to the city tavern, dined together, and took leave of each other. The Constitution is the foundation of American law and politics. It is the oldest written national constitution in use today. The Constitution is why we are here this evening and able to experience the upcoming debate. May we be tolerant and respectful of one and all. Thank you for your attention.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're glad you're here for this historic night in Hampton. My name is Kent Mullenbeck. I'm the president of the Greater Franklin County Area Chamber of Commerce. And I'm standing on the right side of the stage tonight because that's where I'm at politically.
My name is Megan Rosenberg, and I'm vice president of the chamber. And I'm on the left side of the stage because, as we all know, right is not always right, Kent. Kent and I don't agree on much politically, but we do agree that one of the two candidates we're about to hear from will have the privilege of representing the greatest congressional district in the nation soon.
Now that, I can agree, is right. For those of you that don't know Megan, let me tell you a little bit about her. She can be as stubborn as a donkey. but she's a great big help in the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, thank you, Ken. And although we are on different sides of the aisle, I have to admire how dedicated Ken is to his party. He only checks out books from the Reagan Library. He has asked his CPA if donations to the Pentagon are tax deductible.
Makes sense.
And he tried to go as far as naming his children Deduction 1 and Deduction 2.
Well, I have to hand it to Megan, too, because she's very committed also. She's the only person I know that has the ACLU on speed dial. And Megan still is under the impression that Carter and Clinton are going to be added to the Mount Rushmore. Finally, she is so committed that she actually has the entire Kennedy clan tattooed on her back.
And I'll show anyone later that wants to see that. When asked what he thinks of Marx and Lenin, Kent always answers, "I like Groucho, but I'm not into rock music." He spent his entire childhood thinking, "I cannot wait to go to business school." That's not to say Kent's no fun. He once broke loose at a party and removed his necktie.
Well, everybody, I'm sure, by now knows that Megan is fun, but she's also very optimistic. She still thinks that Ralph Nader is going to be president. And she actually still thinks that she's going to collect on Social Security. Can you believe that? But she does know her Constitution, and she's very supportive of it. But when she rallies for the Constitution, she always seems to forget about the Second Amendment. In all seriousness, we are both very pleased that you guys are our guests in our community tonight. The Chamber is very active in promoting tourism and business development and retail trade, and to try to improve the quality of life in our community. We've been active in the past year. We've had a lot of success with building a new bike trail that's been taking several years to finish. And we'd like to have you come and ride it someday or walk it. We also have a new swimming pool park with a lot of new recreation up there. And in the past few years, we've helped to save the Main Street organization for Hampton to keep the historic quality of our buildings intact, including this historic Windsor Theater. And so we're active, and one of our business promotions is the Buy One Product Locally, which is displayed proudly up here with our toilet paper statue over here. And there's information about that in your packets, along as we try to encourage people to buy one product locally to add more business to our community. But Megan and I, we don't always see things the same on issues-wise, but when it comes to business, we know how to work together for the good of our community, and we put our differences aside for business.
On behalf of the Chamber, I too thank you all for coming tonight, and please join me in welcoming Leon Keener to the stage.
Just while they're setting a few things behind stage, I just want to draw your attention to the Class Act brochures that were in your packets when you came in. Like I said, my name is Leon Keener. I am the Franklin County Arts Council representative on the Windsor Theater Board. We are right now in the process of raising funds to add digital projection here to the Windsor Theater, and also to renovate our stage and making it more workable for live performances, both theatrical and musical. As of right now, as of today, we already hit $45,000 out of our $120,000 goal. And so we've been doing really well. And so, yes, let's give a great round of applause for our community. And so I would just like to encourage all of you, if you have not given, all the information is in here, and we encourage you to donate to the Windsor Theater Renovation Fund. As part of this fundraising campaign, the Franklin County Arts Council is kind of doing early birthday celebration of the Windsor Theater, which was built in 1913. And so what we're going to do is recreate the entertainment that would have been in the Windsor Theater in 1917. So we'll be doing a 20-minute Charlie Chaplin movie with a 20-piece orchestra and a vaudeville show. So it's really going to be a lot of fun. We encourage you to come in costume if you'd like. Tickets will go on sale Wednesday. The show is Saturday, October 6th at 7:30 here at the Windsor Theater, and the tickets are $10 each. They're available at Center One and will be available at the door. It is now my pleasure to introduce our moderator for our debate this evening, the President and CEO of Mid-America Publishing, Ryan Harvey.
Thank you for coming tonight.
I'm excited to present tonight's debate at the historic Windsor Theater here in Hampton. My name is Ryan Harvey, and I'm president and CEO of MidAmerica Publishing. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Steve King and candidate Christy Vilsack and their campaigns for agreeing to tonight's event. I hope it is informative to everyone who is either sitting here in the audience, listening over the radio, or listening via our live web stream, or watching it around the community at one of our three watch parties. I'd like to thank the many people who emailed questions in to me prior to tonight's debate. Unfortunately, I've received many more questions than I could even remotely ask. I've carefully considered each one and tried to craft the final questions in a way to which the candidates can answer as many of them as possible. I'd like to thank the Greater Franklin County Area Chamber of Commerce for arranging for the event. Brooke and his staff has done a terrific job of preparing for the evening's activities. I'd like to thank them for allowing me to moderate the debate and for working through some of the hassles it takes to get ready for such an event. Last but certainly not least, I'd like to thank our timer for this evening's event, Jim Davies. Jim is armed with a pair of paddles in order to notify the candidates as their time is coming to an end. If there are 15 seconds remaining, Jim will extend the yellow paddle so the candidates are aware. And when time expires, the red paddle will be raised. The format for tonight's debate will be that each candidate will have a 3-minute opening remark. And once those remarks are completed, I will ask a series of 9 questions. Each candidate will receive the same question asked by me and have 2 minutes to respond. The candidate who initially fielded the question will have a 1-minute rebuttal time. Again, thank you for attending tonight's debate, and let me begin by introducing our two participants. The former First Lady of Iowa, Christy Vilsack, is a native Iowan committed to a life of public service. She is a career educator who has always been willing to step up to the plate to build strong communities, whether as a teacher, activist, or Iowa's leading volunteers First Lady. Vilsack is a passionate and tireless advocate fighting to make Iowa an even better place to live, work, and raise a family. Born and raised in Mount Pleasant, Christy is a 1972 graduate of Kirkland College in Clinton, New York, and received a master's degree in journalism from the University of Iowa in 1992. She and Tom married in 1973, having met while students at Hamilton and Kirkland Colleges. After Tom finished law school, they moved to Mount Pleasant, where she taught and Tom practiced law. Together, they raised 2 sons, Jess and Doug, and have 2 grandchildren. Christy is actively involved in strengthening communities in Iowa and nationally by advocating for family literacy, public and school libraries, and computer literacy. For 18 years, she taught middle school and high school language arts and journalism. For 6 years, she taught English and journalism at Iowa Wesleyan College. She also worked as a reporter and columnist for the Mount Pleasant News for many years and more recently created a column for Offenberger.com. When Christie's husband was elected governor in 1998, she had the honor to serve as Iowa's First Lady. In that role, she continued her lifelong commitment to healthy adolescents and communities. Best known for creating a statewide literacy initiative, from 2000 to 2006, Christy raised funds to give a book to every kindergartner in Iowa. She also traveled the state advocating for education and economic development initiatives on behalf of the governor's office and represented Iowa in 9 countries. Again, please welcome to the stage, Christy Vilsack. Congressman Steve King is familiar with justice and laws of government, having grown up in a law enforcement family in Storm Lake, Iowa. He attended Denison Community High School, where he met Marilyn Kelly, whom he married in 1972. The King family set down their roots in southern Sac County on an acreage between Oldable and Kieron. The King family has lived in Kieron for 38 years and are members of St. Martin's Church in Oldable. Steve and Marilyn have 3 grown sons and 5 grandchildren. King built his business and founded King Construction in 1975. He began his business with 1 bulldozer and built it into a company that continues today under the ownership and management of his oldest son. One of the many lessons learned while growing both of his family and his business was that government is overreaching, and too often elected officials were unwilling to be a part of the solution. King, finding himself frustrated with the status quo, climbed down off his bulldozer and ran for state senate. Serving 6 years in the Iowa Senate, then-Senator Steve King served as the chairman of the State Government Committee and vice chairman of the Oversight Budget Committee. A fearless leader in the state senate, he was also a member of the Appropriations Committee, Judiciary Committee, Business and Labor Committee, and the Commerce Committee. King's lifelong work ethic has served him well as a member of Congress. Elected in 2002 to the U.S. House of Representatives, he spends a tremendous amount of time in the district engaging his constituents. King is well respected among national conservative leaders as the general on the front lines. King is a passionate defender of the sanctity of life, remains a national and steadfast voice of the unborn. He also made renewable energy his first priority as a member of Congress. King's legislation provides a small producer tax credit for ethanol companies was signed into law. Another current important issue to King is his legislation to fully repeal Obamacare. The full repeal was passed by the U.S. House this session with King's language. King's accomplishments are recognized not only in Iowa, but on a national level as a congressman and a statesman fighting to preserve our Constitution, showing a transparent and consistent pattern of supporting the rule of law and intent to dramatically decrease the size of government. Please help me welcome to the stage Representative Steve King. Tonight's debate will begin with Mrs. Vilsack beginning with the opening remarks. Representative King will follow with his opening remarks.
First of all, thanks for all of you for coming, for all of those who are out there listening, and thank you to MidAmerican and to the Chamber for having us here and for the great celebration of the Constitution. You know, I'm running for Congress for one reason. I want to make sure that people can continue to live in small towns and small cities in this district. And in order to do that, we have to create layers and layers of economic opportunity and make sure we rebuild the middle class. And I have a plan for doing that, which revolves around three things. It revolves around education, innovation, and connection. I want to build a workforce with education. I want to make sure we build on what we've already done with renewable fuels and wind and innovation and create a new layer of economic opportunity surrounding a bio-based economy and small business. And I also want to connect every small town to high-speed internet and broadband and make sure that we rebuild our roads and bridges and short rail, especially Highway 20 and improving Highway 30. As I traveled around this district for the last year and a half, and in the 15 years preceding it, I've talked a lot about the values that we have in common and the values that we share. And one of the values that was talked about most often was service to country. And I've asked people a lot about what values we all share. And service to country, I think, is an important one. And basically, I would like to dedicate this debate tonight to all the young people who are serving out there and to their parents who are here at home and have supported them. I'd like to dedicate it to my nephew, Lance Corporal, Marine Lance Corporal Sam Bell, who just got back from Afghanistan having served 7 months in a remote area of that country and putting himself in harm's way. And you know, we can all welcome them home and we can sing the Star Spangled Banner, we can salute the flag, but the way that we could really help them is to make sure that we provide the kinds of jobs that they'll want to come home to, and that we can say to them, we want you to come back to these small towns and these small cities, and we want you to be leaders in these small towns and small cities, and we want to provide the kinds of jobs that you want to come home to, whether it's maybe being troubleshooting one of those wind turbines out there, or maybe it's creating a whole new business of drop-in biofuels so that we no longer have to use foreign oil in our Navy planes. Maybe it's becoming a farmer, and we need to make those opportunities available, and I'm trying to do that with my plan for revitalizing the middle-class economy in these small towns. You know, Congressman King had the opportunity to vote for extra duty pay for these young soldiers. And he was the deciding vote to make sure that they didn't get the extra duty pay that they had. And I would like to challenge him to suggest that he give back the 5 pay raises that he took during the hardest economic times in this country. Thanks a lot.
Congressman King.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much to our hosts, and thanks for the rolling green rooms out on the street, too. I appreciate that. I wanted to come in here early and here in time to see the reenactment of the signing of our Constitution 225 years ago today. I'm very glad that we came together for this, and that the debate here tonight, I think, helped this reenactment come out. And, you know, for me, I serve on the Constitution Committee in the United States Congress, and there aren't a lot of people that sign up for that. I wanted to make sure I was on that committee. I've been on that committee every year, and we have some profound constitutional arguments. But the foundation for this country is written in that Constitution. And here's what I believe, that the Declaration of Independence was written with divine guidance. The Constitution was written with divine guidance. I would agree with Ben Franklin on those points. And it is a rare thing in history to see the idea of the laws of nature and nature's God come out of the mouths and minds of our founding fathers and go onto that parchment page of that declaration, which I for years kept on the wall in my office, the full replica of the declaration, and that be the foundation for our country that inspires us today, and the declaration being the foundation for the Constitution that was reenacted here. And I carry with me, and I didn't hear all of the introduction, but I carry with me a Constitution in my jacket pocket every day. Quite often you will hear me introduced by saying he's never caught without a Constitution in his pocket. Well, that was true for years, and now that they introduced me that way, now I'm really never caught without a Constitution in my pocket. But this means a lot, and I have a couple of them that are completely worn out that are in my glass coffee table in my office in Washington, D.C. One of them is signed by Justice Scalia, and they told me, get that out of your pocket. That's an heirloom. Put it in that coffee table. And I did, and the next one I carried around till it wore out was signed by Justice Thomas. Same thing happened. Now they're both in there side by side. This is signed by Federal Judge Mark Bennett, who happens to be a Democrat, but we have a mutual respect for each other's reverence for this Constitution. Here's what's ahead for us. The destiny of America is ahead for us. This is a destiny election. It's not just the most important election of our lifetime. That's every election is the most important. The direction of America will be determined by this upcoming election. And you can follow the path of this Constitution, this limited government, this constitutional republic that we are. And by the way, this Constitution guarantees us a republican form of government. You can follow this Constitution, or you can turn the other way and follow our leader who has not done so and has undermined, I think, the underpinnings of America. We need to go towards free enterprise and have a real free market out there. We need people to be independent and free from the oppressive reach of an over-regulatory federal government. And I would encourage all of you to listen carefully to this. I'll be talking to you about issues and policy, where we've been and where we need to go. And I think you'll hear something different on the other side in this debate if the last two debates have been any indication. So thanks, and I look forward to the questions, and I appreciate you all being here.
Mrs. Vilsack, from your perspective, how successful has the No Child Left Behind program been? And if elected, what areas do you feel are successful, and how would you propose to improve the program?
Well, first of all, let me say that the federal government has a very limited role in education. As we know, and we're very proud here in Iowa, that we like local control. And most of the decisions that are made about education should be made at the local level by local school boards and certainly at the state level. But at the federal level, we have the opportunity to provide access to education. And so I'm especially interested in making sure that we support head start and give people a good start, but I'm also very interested as a career teacher for 38 years in making sure that we have quality K-12 education. And so No Child Left Behind has been a problem, I think, and people consider it a problem whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or Independents, because it's been very restrictive. And we need to make some major changes in No Child Left Behind. And the most important thing we can do is to make sure that we pay attention to making sure that we have the very best teachers, because the best opportunity for our young people is to have a good teacher in the classroom. We certainly need to make sure that everyone has access to a good education, and No Child Left Behind, as it was originally intended, would have done that. And the federal government needs to make sure that everybody has an access to a good education, but we also need to make sure that that education is not prohibited and restricted by teaching completely to the test. So I'm very much in favor of revising No Child Left Behind, but I would like to point out that we have no education bill. And Congressman King has had the opportunity to take up an education bill. He's had the opportunity to vote for education, and he has chosen to support the Ryan bill, which would remove billions of dollars from education, and I would like to call on him to reconsider his votes in that respect, because it's hard to have quality education in this country and move people on to higher education if we don't have the resources to do that. Thanks.
Congressman King, from your perspective, how successful has the No Child Left Behind program been? And if reelected, what areas do you feel are successful, and how would you propose to improve the program?
Okay. Well, I think by now we see the pattern. At the end of the gentlelady's time, she's going to ask me a question and make a charge, and I'm not going to spend my time defending baseless charges here tonight. I'm going to address the issues as they're asked by the moderator, but just watch the pattern as it unfolds. No Child Left Behind is something that George Bush offered, that Teddy Kennedy supported. He was there at the bill signing ceremony. It recognized something across America that I think is important for us to think, even here from Iowa. We have often been at the very top of education here in this state. It's digressed some in the last few years, but I remember time after time after time, we would be in first, second, or third place with Minnesota and Wisconsin on the ACT test scores. That's a pretty good measure of how we're educating, especially because we have a very high participation rate in ACT test scores. But as I deliberated on whether I would support No Child Left Behind, and I was not in Congress when that came through, but I evaluated like any other citizen did, and I was serving in the Iowa Senate at the time. I looked at Iowa and I thought, you know, we have a good educational system here in the state. We have a good parochial school system. We have a good public school system. We have an emerging homeschool system. All of that adds to competition, and it makes us better. But I remember also when Bill Clinton was running for president, and they said when they talked about education, thank God for Mississippi, because Arkansas was 49th and Mississippi was 50th out of the states in educating their young people. Those states didn't make the commitment that we made here in Iowa, and their young people suffered. And here in Iowa, we have a deep commitment to education that goes clear back to the country school, where you'd have a 4 mile by 4 mile, 16 sections funding a country school. Up and down the road, you could see that over and over again. Landowners paid the taxes, they hired the teacher, they set the curriculum, and that built the foundation for the commitment we have to education. No Child Left Behind, as it was passed and as it is as implemented, it does this. It holds some people accountable to do a better job. Our administrators say they appreciate that. Our teachers say they don't appreciate that, and that's one of the reasons for the strikes in Chicago that we've seen. So I want to look at this unbalance, and we should improve the system, but I think that we hold with the information that comes from the teachers, and I'm going to take my advice from Marilyn, who taught for a lot of years, and that's my wife.
Congressman King, what changes would you like to see to the Affordable Care Act and why? And as a follow-up, if there are three portions of the Affordable Care Act that you would like to keep, what would they be?
There's one change that I'm for in what now has been renamed. There's one change that I'm for in what now has been renamed the Affordable Care Act. I just point out to you that the title of the bill is the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Nobody knew what that meant. Barack Obama identified it as Obamacare February 25th of 2000 and, get my year right here, I better be sure, 2009, I believe it was. And so that's what it's known as. America understands what it is. But here's what I'm for. That change is the full 100% repeal of Obamacare. Pull it all out by the roots so we can start over and reform our health care system. That's job one. And there's no part of that that I think is worth keeping the whole bill in place for. There are some components of it that we can discuss, but there are many pieces to reform healthcare that are far more important than the components that are part of Obamacare that I think have some merit. In Iowa, for example, you're going to hear that we should preserve the 26-year mandate. It's completely redundant in Iowa. Iowa legislature has passed a mandate that requires that the insurance companies allow the children of parents who are in school to stay on until they're 25 years old. The major insurance companies have already adopted the 26-year mandate, and they are not going to change it. And I looked the main CEO in the eye when he told me that just a few months ago. So there's the other piece of this that has to do with pre-existing conditions. And all of us who've studied it know that if you offer and require a mandate to issue insurance to people with pre-existing conditions, when you do that, you have to also have the individual mandate to go with that. I have long opposed the individual mandate. The solution for pre-existing conditions is for the states to set up a high-risk pool. We've done that in Iowa, and I've been part of the management of that as the chairman of the State Government Committee in the Iowa Senate. Those two things, well, let's bring this thing back to the other side. Let's pull it all out by the roots, and let's start over so we can preserve the doctor-patient relationship.
First of all, I missed Mrs. Vilsack's rebuttal time, so Congressman King won't be able to rebut this question to keep things fair. What changes would you like to see to the Affordable Care Act and why? And as a follow-up, what three portions of the Affordable Care Act would you like to keep, and what would they be?
Well, let me start with the parts that we'd like to keep. I think it's a good bill. It's got some flaws. We need to work on those, but it's a good place to start. And we need to move forward. So I was, my car broke down by the side of the road not too long ago, and a young man towed me into Ames. And as we were traveling, I asked him about his circumstances, and he said he was very fortunate to be able to continue. He's newly married, was fortunate to be able to continue for a year on his parents' health insurance. And I thought that was a great thing for him, because he was really strapped for money and he didn't have a high-paying job. And so certainly keeping young people on their parents' insurance is really, really important. Pre-existing conditions are really, really important as well. But it's also really important that we find cost savings, because the biggest problem with the health care reform bill is that we need to continue to find ways to save money. And one of the best ways to do that, and I've outlined what I think are 7 or 8 really good ideas for starting to work on reforming the Affordable Care Act, the best thing that we need to do is to make sure that we pay for, not pay for services, but we pay for results. If you want to see a good example of this, a pilot project is now working in Fort Dodge. They have received money from the Innovation Fund for Medicare and Medicaid. And there are a lot of states working on this issue as well, trying to figure out how we pay to keep people out of hospitals and out of clinics, how to make sure that in a person's lifetime they only have one knee replacement, not 3 knee replacements. And so I think we can work on the cost part of this, but we need to move forward together. And Congressman King doesn't have a plan. He only wants to talk about how to take us backward, not take us forward. And I think this is the time in our nation's history when we need to come together and work together in bipartisan fashion. That's what I'll do.
Mrs. Vilsack, thanks to legislative members on both sides of the aisle, our national financial situation is putting us in a very sticky situation. What legislation would you move forward to get our financial house back in order? For all practical purposes, U.S. Treasury is now close to bankruptcy, and how would you propose to reverse the $16-plus trillion deficit we currently face?
Am I going first?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, when Congressman came to office, we had a $6 trillion debt. Now we have a $16 trillion debt. And he's had 10 years to balance the budget, and he hasn't done it. What he has done is that he basically supported two wars that we didn't pay for. He supported Medicare Part D, which he didn't pay for. And he also supported tax cuts for people who make more than $1 million. So we need to balance our budget. That's one of the most important things Congress needs to do, and they haven't done it. And he's had 10 years to do it. And I would like for him to say that he wouldn't take a pay raise until he balances that budget. But I think what we need to do in order to balance the budget is, first of all, have a balanced approach. And that means making sure that we target some cuts. We've already done that to a certain extent. We need to target spending so that we can grow this economy, and we need to ask people who make $1 million to pay a little bit more. But really, it's about focusing on the middle class. And what I've tried to do in talking about this is to make it very local. And I think if you go to my website, ChristyVilsack4Iowa.com, you'll see a 7 or 8 part plan where I've talked about how we create a vibrant economy right here. And I think that it can be a model for the whole country. And it is based, as I said, on education, innovation, and connection. And it's about creating a workforce. It's about having an energy policy and growing the jobs that we're already creating here. It's about conservation and outdoor recreation policy. It's about making sure that we have an education policy. We need to grow this economy, and the best way to do that is to jumpstart the economy by having a roadmap, having some legislation that will show us what direction to go, making sure that we have an education bill, an energy bill, and all the other legislation that is not taking place because of gridlock in Congress.
Congressman King, thanks to legislative members on both sides of the aisle, our national financial situation is putting us in a very sticky situation. What legislation would you move forward to get our financial house back in order? For all practical purposes, the U.S. Treasury is now close to bankrupt. How would you propose reversing the $16-plus trillion deficit?
Well, thank you. First, I'll notice that I'm keeping track of baseless charges. I'm up to 8. And I'm going to continue to talk about policy and issues and how we get this country in the right direction. But my record is strong and it's clear. And first of all, the budget's going to get balanced when we have a majority of the people in the House and the Senate and a president who believe in doing so. And if they balance the budget, and if we succeed in balancing a budget that doesn't pay off our national debt, that's going to take a long-term commitment to pay off $16 trillion in national debt. When I first went to Congress, I went to the budget chairman and I said, where's our balanced budget? His answer was, we can't balance the budget. We've been attacked. We're in war in Afghanistan. We're probably going to end up in war in Iraq. And he was right. Our financial centers were attacked in the Twin Towers on September 11th. We had to stand up national security all over the country, including TSA and a number of other systems that were out there. He said, we can't balance the budget. Well, I thought we could. I went back to write that balanced budget, and we weren't able to get that put together. Republican Study Committee, I began to press to bring a balanced budget out of there that would get us where we need to go. That took a few more years to convince my colleagues to stand with me and move a balanced budget on the floor of the House of Representatives. We did that, and it was a 10 years to balance offer. And each year we've said, okay, now we're going to stick to our guns. Then it's going to be 9 years, 8 years, 7 years. We're down to 5 years now on the budget that I have offered along with my colleagues. But here's another piece of this record. If somebody wants to wonder, here's a sheet right here. These are 10 simple votes that if the rest of my colleagues had followed my leadership, not only would we have balanced the budget, we would have paid off the national debt. You don't send spenders to Congress to solve the problem. Not enough conservatives there. We need more conservatives in Congress, not less, to solve this problem.
Mrs. Vilsack, you have 1 minute to rebut Congressman King.
I was at the Greene County Fair, and a guy came up to me and he said, you know, I'm not a Republican and I'm not a Democrat. I'm an American. And I wish Congress would start acting like they're Americans too. Well, I'm ready to go to Congress and start acting like an American and balance this budget. Congressman King has been there for 10 years and he hasn't balanced the budget. What has he done? He hasn't balanced the budget. That's the job of the Congress.
Speaking of the budget, I've got a question here. Oh, is this going to fall?
Right.
Yes, it will be. Congressman King, let me find that question. Well, let's switch gears here. We'll come back to that on your next question, Congressman King. Let's take a moment to discuss immigration in the United States. I believe all Americans are in support of legal immigration, but what steps would you encourage Congress to take control of the illegal immigration in our country?
Can you repeat the last part of that?
Sure. What steps would you encourage Congress to take to control illegal immigration in our country?
Okay. Well, thank you. I've been clear on immigration, and I also serve on the Immigration Committee. There's a long record of my stand. At the core of every immigration policy has to be the rule of law. The rule of law is rooted in this Constitution. It's a pillar of American exceptionalism. It's essential. And if we disregard the rule of law with anything that addresses the immigration issue or any other, we're undermining the underpinnings of America. And so I have been to the border multiple times. I have pushed on immigration for a long time. The first job is to stop the bleeding at the border. Next thing is shut off the jobs magnet. Getting those two things done. We have cities that have created themselves as sanctuary cities that simply tell their law enforcement officers, don't gather information, therefore we're not going to help enforce immigration law. This country is being fractured by special interests on both sides of this. Democrats who believe they need to expand the dependency class in the country, and some Republicans and Democrats in the business world that want cheap labor. What we need, what the thing that I have promoted here that I believe has the best component of the solution is a piece of legislation that an idea that came to me one morning early, and it's called the New Idea Act. Even the name of it, the New Illegal Deduction Elimination Act. What it does is it brings the IRS into this, and it gives the employer safe harbor if they use E-Verify. But it clarifies that wages and benefits paid to illegals are not tax deductible for income tax purposes. The result of that is that when the IRS does a normal audit, then that money that they deny as a deductibility goes over and shows up on the profit side and it becomes taxable income. Your $10 an hour illegal becomes a $16 an hour illegal, and employers who get safe harbor for using E-Verify will eventually clean up their workforce, and we will have stopped the bleeding at the border and shut off the jobs magnet, and then we can deal with what's left.
Mrs. Vilsack, let's take a moment to discuss immigration in the United States. I believe all Americans are in support of legal immigration. What steps would you encourage Congress to take to control illegal immigration in our country?
Well, the most important thing we need to do is to secure our borders. We need to make sure that people are not coming across illegally, that drugs and guns are not coming across illegally. We also need to make sure that Americans, lawful Americans, have a first chance at the jobs. But we need comprehensive immigration reform. And again, Congressman King has not led on this. He's had 10 years to create a roadmap for us. People in this state and in this country want to follow the rules, but they need to know what the rules are. I have been meeting with people, I'm sure Congressman King has been meeting with a lot of the same people in this district who are employing immigrants, and they have certainly asked him to tone down his rhetoric. They have talked to me about immigration reform, and they've talked about the importance of these immigrants to our state and to the economic vibrancy of the places where they work, whether it's dairy farmers or whether it's people producing hogs or whether it's people producing eggs. But we need immigrants in this country and in this state for the economic vibrancy because we produce food here. But we also need immigrants in this country who have come here to go to college, and we need to make sure that they have an opportunity to stay here because they tend to become entrepreneurs. But I would like to say that Steve King has not led on this issue. If he were a leader on this issue, his leader, Speaker Boehner, would have appointed him to lead the subcommittee on immigration, but he chose not to do that because of his extreme views on this issue.
Congressman King, you have 1 minute as a rebuttal.
Thank you. Baseless charges 10, 11, and 12. We continue. And the question was, what would you do from the United States Congress to control illegal immigration? That was a question. I didn't hear an answer. My answer was, move the New Idea Act, the Illegal Deduction Elimination Act, bring the IRS into this, and require the Social Security Administration and the Department of Homeland Security to have a working team so the right hand, the left hand, and the middle hand knows what the other's doing in government. That's how you get things done in here, and this is very close. If we can elect a president and we can elect a majority in the Senate, this bill has a good chance to become law. We've got broad support. I've been working on it for a long time. But it isn't about the what your feelings are. This is about how we protect and preserve the rule of law and implement those kind of things that bring about a kind of an immigration policy that recognizes the sovereignty of the United States of America.
Mrs. Vilsack, reported unemployment numbers in the United States continue to stay above 8% and have done so for over 3 years. What role does the U.S. government play in job creation, and what types of legislation would you put forward to assist in creating jobs for all Americans?
Thank you. I think the rest of the country might take a lesson from Iowa. In this district, on the western side of the district, we have 2% unemployment, and on the eastern side, it's about 5%. And one of the reasons for that is because we have invested in the last 15 years in renewable fuels and wind. This district is the richest agricultural space in the world. Plus, we have 2,000 of the state's 3,000 wind turbines. And so this means that in order to create jobs here and across the country, that we really could invest in making sure that we're creating the kinds of jobs in small businesses that rely on the raw materials that are within 10 or 15 miles of the small places where we live. Some of you may have noticed that I carry this football with me, and there are a number of reasons why I carry it, but this football is made from soybeans. And the cars that you drove here tonight, the seats are made from soybeans. And we can make asphalt. The best adherent for asphalt is actually hog manure. So we can take the dandelions that grow out there and we can turn it into a substitute for rubber, and we can create in this state and across the country products that are now going to be made from plants rather than petroleum. And that will do several things. It will create quality jobs, value-added jobs, but it will also create opportunity to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. So I think what's good for Iowa is good for the whole country, and that we should look to making an economy that is based on lots of small businesses that will make sure that we can invite our children and our grandchildren back to Iowa to enjoy the kinds of layers of prosperity that I'm trying to create here and to rebuild the middle class.
Congressman King, reported unemployment numbers in the United States continue to stay above 8% and have done so for over 3 years. What role does the U.S. government play in job creation, and what types of legislation would you put forward to assist in creating jobs for all Americans?
Well, I'd start with this, that I actually started a small business in 1975, and I had a negative net worth of $5,000, and I convinced a banker to loan me 100% to buy an old beaten-up bulldozer, and I welded on it for 2 weeks and rolled it out. Before I made my first $100, the engine blew up. I drug it back into the yard, and we tore it all down. We had just enough credit to buy enough parts that we could bolt it back together, and Marilyn, who's here in the audience, was 4.5 months pregnant with our first child. She's out there on the tracks of a D7 with a 7-foot cheater pipe in the rain torquing the head bolts. That's how we got started. So, and the opportunities today are harder. My oldest son owns that company today, and they're doing a great job, and they're working all over western Iowa, and they've got an interest up in North Dakota as well between our boys. But here's what is going on. The tax rate's too high. The regulatory rate is too high. The burden of the government regulation is intimidating to entrepreneurs. And by the way, if you think in terms of create jobs, you don't do that without employers. employers have to have, or prospective employers who are the entrepreneurs, have to have a prospect for profit and an opportunity for them to operate in the out years, not just in the short term, but in the out years. There needs, that means we have to have tax rates that are stable and predictable. We have to have a regulatory system that is not constantly growing and reaching into every aspect of our lives. The first two things we could do, the most important is to be able to freeze our tax rates and tell people they're not going up. Second is, the regulation side of this, I introduced regulation here before we came back for this August break, that requires our agencies to offer up 10% of their regulation a year, each year, so Congress votes on it. We can shrink regulation, we can have low tax rates, but we need to send a pro-business climate out there or we're not going to have jobs because there won't be a prospect for profit and people won't be hired. And those who don't have jobs, I would tell them, if you can't find one, start a business. You'll feel good about yourself and you'll create the jobs that way.
Mrs. Vilsack, you have 1 minute for rebuttal.
Well, I think one of the most important things we could do is support renewable fuels and wind. And part of that will be protecting the renewable fuel standard, which is a mandate to be sure that we produce 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels. But it also means that we need support for wind, and we haven't been able to get the production tax credit right now. So I would like to suggest that Congressman King step up and be a leader. The first thing he could do would be to sign the farm bill, or get the farm bill out there and get it signed, because that would create the kind of economic opportunity we need here. But he has not been a consistent champion of wind or renewable fuels in this state, and I will.
Congressman King, many nations around the world require voters to show proof of their identity when they come to the polls. Recently, a poll at the Iowa State Fair said 75% of those asked supported a law here in Iowa requiring IDs to be shown. How would you propose Americans show proof of their identity without suppressing the vote of legal voters? Is there a credible argument for or against a photo ID requirement when voting?
Okay, well, thank you. We are up to baseless charge number 15. I'm just keeping you posted on my score here. And this is an issue, picture ID for voting, a photo ID, a government-issued photo ID for voting is something I do have a long history with. I chaired the Iowa Senate State Government Committee in the year 2000 when we had the fiasco in Florida. And other than 3 days where I had a conference in Chicago, I spent the rest of the time focusing on this, actually day and night. And I believe that my responsibility was to turn Iowa around in the right direction so that we didn't become Florida. Here's what I learned. I learned that there is significant voter fraud across the country. And I did get involved in shutting off the funding to Acorn, which produced over 440,000 false or fraudulent voter registrations. In fact, in addition to my constitution, I carry an Acorn in my pocket every day, so that I remember what they tried to do to the foundation underneath our Constitution. But we need to do more than just a picture ID. I brought legislation through the Iowa Senate then that required that the voter registration list be certified to be free of duplicates, deceased, and felons, to require a picture ID and require that they certify their citizenship. That's not too big of an ask. If it takes a photo ID to rent a movie or get on an airplane or go visit a United States senator in the federal building in Des Moines, Iowa, or in Sioux City or wherever it might be, you can produce a picture ID that gets you to select the next leader in the free world. And for those who say they don't have an identification and they can't afford to get one, the Department of Transportation, in those days at least, for $5 you could get one. I'd say this, go ahead, we'll give you that ID, but let's make sure that we certify the citizenship and that the list is free of duplicates, deceased, and felons. Put that picture ID up there. There's no reason for anybody to defend anything else because there's voter fraud that's determining these elections and it's got to stop.
Mrs. Vilsack, many nations around the world require voters to show proof of their identity when they come to the polls. Recently, a poll at the Iowa State Fair said 75% of those asked supported a law here in Iowa requiring IDs to be shown. How would you propose Americans show proof of their identity without suppressing the vote of legal voters? Is there a credible argument for or against a photo ID?
I think that we should do everything in this country, especially since we're celebrating the Constitution today. We should do everything we possibly can to encourage every person to vote. And it is restrictive in many cases for people who are elderly. There are a lot of situations where people don't have a picture ID and they need to be able to vote. And I think that the most important thing we can do is to make sure that people are allowed to vote. And I don't think that there is any evidence that there is a great deal of voter fraud out there. And I think that... the most important right and responsibility a person has in this country to be able to vote. And I'll do everything I can to make sure people are allowed to do it.
Representative King, you have 1 minute for rebuttal.
Well, I heard that. We should do all we can to encourage every person to vote. I don't agree. I completely don't agree. I think they need to be citizens of the United States of America in order to cast a ballot. And if you think about those who are not, there are people here that might be visiting America. They might be on a green card. They might be here illegally. And there are people out there recruiting them to vote now. We've got to stop that before we turn this country over to people that are not American citizens. I've dug into this thing since the year 2000. I've been deeply into it. There's books out there written on this. We've held hearings in the United States Congress. I've testified before the United States Congress on voter fraud. It is not a gimmick. It is not a story. It is real, and it's affecting the destiny of this country, and it's got to stop, and Matt Schultz has got the right plan. We need voter picture ID in Iowa, and we need to go beyond Matt Schultz's bill and do more.
Mrs. Vilsack, let's turn our attention to alternative energy. Focusing specifically on wind power and biofuels, as they are both becoming extremely important to the Iowa economy. What are your plans and policies regarding the development and production of these energy resources?
Well, I have an energy plan that you can look at in more detail on my website, but I actually think that the Congress, because they haven't been able to come up with an energy bill, should be relieved of the responsibility of energy in this country, and that we should have a commission appointed by the president and affirmed by the Senate, who would be charged with, much like the Federal Reserve Board is, charged with looking at a 50-year plan, a short-term, medium-term, and long-term plan for energy. Because right now, because we elect people to Congress every 2 years, and because there's gridlock in Congress and they can't seem to make a decision, we are at a distinct disadvantage. So I also think I want to be a champion of wind and renewable fuels every day that I'm in Congress. And I want to be a consistent champion of wind and renewable fuels. And I think that anybody who's in Congress should, and from Iowa in this delegation, should be a consistent champion of biofuels, renewable fuels, ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, because we'll have the first and the third cellulosic ethanol, second generation ethanol plant in this district. I think one of the most important things right now that should be happening in Congress is a farm bill, which would go a long way to making sure that we have stability and that people can invest in the renewable fuel industry in this state and in this country. But we don't have a farm bill. And we don't have a farm bill because there hasn't been leadership on the farm bill. And the Senate, to their credit, was able to pass a farm bill, a bipartisan bill, a good bill, but the House has not been able to pass it. And I think Steve King should have shown more leadership on this and should have pounded on the door of Speaker Boehner and followed the lead of Kristi Noem in South Dakota in making sure that we have a farm bill, because the House bill completely leaves out the title that has to do with biofuels. And I'd like to understand why.
Congressman King, Let's turn our attention to alternative energy, focusing specifically on wind power and biofuels, as both becoming increasingly important to the Iowa economy. What are your plans and policies regarding the development and production of these energy resources?
Well, I'm not really sure if Mrs. Vilsack wants me to lead, be a leader or a follower. I've gotten advice to be both a leader and a follower, and depends on the issue. But I am grateful for the compliment that she's given me, that a person in Congress should be the champion of renewable energy. How about the wind energy championship that was awarded to me by the American Wind Energy Association? They know what they're doing. How about the support of the ethanol industry? They know what they're doing. About support of the Farm Bureau as friend of agriculture. They know what they're doing. So do the corn growers. The list goes on. But here's where I am and here's where I've been. The first piece of legislation that I introduced as a freshman member of Congress went on to become law, and it was the foundation for renewable energy in this country. And today I represent the 5th Congressional District of Iowa. That's the 32 counties that are the western third of the state. And those 32 counties are 1/435th of the population of the United States. They're the number one renewable energy producing congressional district in the entire United States of America. And the new 4th district will be bigger yet and have more influential yet. And nobody in the industry wonders where I have been or where I am on that issue. I'm not here to take the credit for all they've done. They put risk capital out there. They were smart business people. We needed to provide market access. We did some good things in Congress to get that jump started, and we need to keep this industry going. Another thing that we can do for energy prices here is build the Keystone XL pipeline. It is a shame that the president has blocked that. And it's a shame that Prime Minister Harper had to negotiate with the Chinese, where they have an agreement now. You will see Canadian oil going to China to be refined instead of coming down through the United States in a Keystone XL pipeline because the president blocked it. No rational reason.
Mrs. Vilsack, you have 1 minute for rebuttal.
Sure. You say you're a leader, but you have voted inconsistently against wind and against biofuels, and I would be happy to hand you a list of all the times you've done that over the last few years. You didn't show up for the vote on the renewable fuel standard, which is one of the most important pieces of legislation, and you have not provided leadership on the production tax credit for wind. So I would be happy to provide all of the examples over the last 4 or 5 years where you have not supported wind and you have not supported renewable fuels. And by not being a leader with the Farm Bill, you have neglected the biofuels industry in the state.
Congressman King, what major components would you like to see in the next Farm Bill and why?
Well, I was able to slip a few major components in there, and some of them I don't want to bring to the attention of the opposition. So I will just tell you that the one that I think is very much worthy of discussion here is the amendment that I offered about 11:45 that night after that 15-hour marathon markup. And it's the amendment we call the PICA Amendment, the Protect Interstate Commerce Amendment. What it does is it prohibits the states from regulating the means of production of agriculture products. You might remember the issue with California CARB and indirect land use when California decided they were going to block Iowa corn-based ethanol from going into California. We had to go to court to get that changed. You might know that California has imposed a regulation on the cage size for hens that are laying eggs outside of the state of California. You might know that they've banned in other from other states gestation crates. Arizona is one of those which prohibits the pork from coming into those states that are not raised in their approved method. These things are all violations of the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. I wrote a bill that I turned into an amendment, which is often the most effective way to pass legislation is by amendment rather than the bill itself. That is on that Farm Bill, it's out of the House Ag Committee Farm Bill, that prohibits the states from regulating the means of production. That shuts down some of HSUS's agenda. They're called the Humane Society of the United States, but they are an anti-meat lobby. And that anti-meat lobby is very active, and they are in opposition to me, and they are in support of my opponent. I don't believe that we should have a meatless Monday at the USDA. I don't think we should be regulating the calories going into our students. They need all of the good, strong, healthy, nutritious food that they can get. There's a lot of the nanny state that's overreached here, but that PICA amendment is the one that has the most far-reaching components, and we're going to hold crop insurance together, and that's the most important thing, actually, after all.
Mrs. Vilsack, what major components would you like to see in the next farm bill, and why?
Well, the farm bill is the most important piece of legislation to people in this state, whether you live on a farm, whether you live in a small town. It is one of the most important pieces of legislation for people who live in rural America. And I'd like to know, where is the farm bill? We need the farm bill before September 30th. And there are other people who are showing leadership right now in the House to get the farm bill taken care of. Kristi Noem, a congresswoman from South Dakota, has been very vocal on this issue, but Congressman King has been missing. Instead of joining the 40-plus farm organizations who got together in Washington the other day, he held a press conference elsewhere and showed up for the photo op at the end. Congressman Bruce Braley has put a petition in the well of the House, and with 218 signatures, it would be able to force the Speaker to take up the farm bill before September 30th. But he has shown no leadership on this. He has not signed it, and I'd like to ask him to go to the well to sign that bill to make sure that we get it. Instead, today, Club for Growth, which has contributed $136,000 to his campaign, has suggested that they were keeping score, and anybody who signs that petition to force the farm bill to a vote will be held accountable for it. This is the most important piece of legislation for rural Iowa and rural America, and two very important titles were left out of it. One was biofuels. So all of the money for biofuels has been left out, and also rural development. So anyone who lives in a small town in the state, anyone who looks at my website for my plan for rural development, must know that without the rural development title, there will be fewer funds, if any, for rural hospitals, for rural schools, for rural libraries, for rural police stations, for rural fire departments. And so we need a farm bill.
Congressman King.
The last farm bill, which I was engaged in as well, didn't receive those kind of accusations. By the way, I'm up to 20 now, Mrs. Vilsack, so I'm going to keep score here. But I was engaged in that as well. It was under Democrat leadership. Chairman was Colin Peterson of Minnesota. He's a good friend. I work with him well. And that farm bill was extended six times. This is much political hype and a lot less about policy than it is about political hype. We are moving forward. We have been working on this. My team has been on this since a year ago last May. And going into this about a month or 5 weeks before we did the markup on the House side, I put extra people on so that we could write things into the bill. We did that. And one of those pieces I just talked about that I've added on is the PICA Amendment, Protect Interstate Commerce Act. So let's have a little patience here. Let's do the right thing. I'm working directly with Chairman Lucas, who is the most frustrated of all, and I spoke with him as I walked in here. That's why I was a few minutes late. We're working to get this done, and I think you know who's actually taking leadership on this. That's not the USDA.
For the final question tonight, the United States House and Senate have not agreed to a budget in nearly 4 years. How important do you believe a comprehensive budget bill is, and how hard would you work to pass one?
Well, I think it's one of the most important things about Congress right now and about this election is temperament. Certainly, we've talked to you a lot about where we stand on different bills, but I think temperament's going to be really important in the future. We need some different lenses in Congress. We need people who can go to Congress who will be problem solvers, not partisan fighters. We need people who can get into a room and who can get along. And right now, one of the reasons we don't have a budget is a balanced budget is because of so much gridlock in Congress. We just need people to get into a room and to be willing to compromise and find a balanced approach to this. As I said before, it requires some targeted spending, it requires some targeted cuts, and it requires making sure that people who make more than $1 million can pay a little bit more. But I think one of the most important things that would also make a difference is if we got our healthcare costs under control. And I have a plan for doing that, and I hope that you'll go to my website and take a look at it. As I said before, in talking with the governor of Oregon, he suggests that if we really move to a coordinated care model, which is what is happening right now in Iowa as our major healthcare concerns are doing this, that we really can save money in healthcare. And he suggests that if we pay for results and not services, that over the course of 10 years, that we could save $1.5 trillion. So I think if we get people in a room, that we can solve these problems and we can balance this budget, but it's going to require people who know how to get along. And that's something that I know how to do. I will bring my problem-solving skills to Congress. And I also want to say that, you know, I think I'm perfectly qualified to go to Congress because I've spent most of my life with eighth graders and I know how to deal with adolescent behavior.
Congressman King, the U.S. House and Senate have not agreed to a budget in nearly 4 years, any comprehensive budget bill since 97. How important is a comprehensive...
Could you just start from the beginning?
Sure, absolutely. The U.S. House and Senate have not agreed to a budget in nearly 4 years, any comprehensive budget bill since 97. How important is a comprehensive budget bill, and how hard would you push to pass one?
Okay, I thought it would be good to go back to that question, and... We have passed a budget out of the House each year the Republicans have been in charge. It's the Senate that hasn't passed a budget. The House and Senate rarely agrees on what a budget is. The President's offered a budget. He offered a budget with a $1.33 trillion deficit spending proposal in it. And when we brought that budget up, there wasn't a single person that voted for it. Not a Democrat in the House of Representatives would support the President's budget. So instead, we brought the Ryan budget. And what do we get for thanks for something out there that does get to balance? We get ridiculed and demagogued over the issue. Solutions are attacked by the other side. When I heard that I want to go to Congress to be a problem solver, not a partisan fighter, I'm having a hard time accepting that at face value, as from what I've seen here tonight. I listened to the statement about the governor of Oregon, that he can save us $1.5 trillion over 10 years. That statement the other night was he could save in the state of Oregon $4 trillion. And I thought about that, and let me see. I don't think that Oregon budget is up over about, let's say less than $40 billion. So if you divide that out, that'd be something like, 100 plus years that you'd have to spend no money in Oregon to get down to that. Now I know the lady has implied that this is now extrapolated across the country. That's a far cry from a proposal that's actually going to get to balance. When you say targeted cuts, what are those targets? You can't get to balance without that. The budget's important. It needs to fit a long-term plan. But I've told you earlier, we're not going to balance this budget by simply political rhetoric or making a statement we're going to do targeted cuts or there's a plan on health care. We balance it this way. We repeal Obamacare. We pass a balanced budget amendment to the states where I'm challenging Iowa to be the first state to ratify that balanced budget amendment. Then we're in the constitutional framework like the states are. Then we solve the problem. Anything short of that's not going to work, and that's the reality of the United States of America today.
Mrs. Vilsack, you have 1 minute for rebuttal.
I'm sorry?
You have 1 minute for rebuttal.
Well, the balanced budget amendment is a gimmick. It would take at least 4 years, and the congressman has suggested maybe 10 years to get a balanced budget amendment passed. What we need is to get people in a room and balance this budget. He's had 10 years to do it. He hasn't done that. In fact, I would suggest, what has he done? He hasn't a bill to his name in the last 10 years except for one that named a post office. So I'd like to know, Congressman, what have you done? We need the budget balanced. All you need to do is get into a room. You could do that tomorrow. but a balanced budget amendment is not going to do the job. It's kicking the can down the road, and you need to take responsibility.
We are now going to move into closing remarks. Congressman King, you have 2 minutes for your closing remarks.
Yes, okay.
2 minutes.
Well, I think we've heard tonight the difference between the two of us as candidates. I will tell you, a balanced budget amendment is an important component to get America where we need to go, to keep us from going what Paul Ryan says is off the fiscal cliff. I'd say instead it's we're floating towards a waterfall, and you can hear the roar of the waterfall now. The day will come when we paddle back upstream as fast as we can, and we can't get away from going over that waterfall into the fiscal insolvency that Greece is looking at today. Will be one huge Greece. We've got to pull back from that. And we can't get back from that unless we first repeal Obamacare. That is a budget saver. That's $2.4 trillion saved over the first full 10 years. That's the start. Those are two pieces of solution. Third one is, you know I'm all energy all the time. And I think it's an insult to the people that have done so much for renewable energy that when they come out and support and endorse me, to imply that they don't know what they're doing in their own business. The people who have voted for me in the last few elections, that know those numbers have gone up, not down. There are 32 counties there, and we had trouble winning two of them. We paid a little more attention. In the last two cycles, we've won every single county, and in those counties we had trouble winning, we won every single precinct. The people that know me best support me the strongest. That's what this campaign is about. Are we going to turn America in the right direction? Are we going to turn America's destiny up? Are we going to be the shining city on the hill that is standing clear and proud and true on those beautiful marble pillars of American exceptionalism? Are we going to defend this Constitution that we celebrated here tonight, or are we going to watch it be eroded by a commander-in-chief who disrespects this Constitution, doesn't believe in free enterprise, doesn't believe in life, and doesn't believe in life and families? There are core values in this country that we must defend at all costs. Thank you very much for being here. God bless you all for defending America.
Mrs. Vilsack, folks, please sit so we can finish.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Vilsack, you have 2 minutes for your closing remarks.
Thank you very much. At a time when our young people were overseas putting themselves in harm's way, Congressman King accepted 5 pay raises. And, you know, he makes $174,000 a year, and I've asked him to return his pay raise. But those young service people make about $48,000 a year, and I know $1,500 may not seem like very much, but I'm sure it seems like a lot to them, and it's a token of our appreciation for them having put themselves in harm's way. And he was the deciding vote. He was the deciding vote. You know, we just see this job differently. He sees the job of being in Congress as a way to promote his own personal agenda and an ideology that has nothing to do with improving the middle class in Iowa and in this district. I see the job much more locally. I want to promote your agenda, and he wants to promote his agenda. You know, in 1974, I received a letter from my dad. And it was on yellow legal tablet, just like the one I'm writing on. And at the top of it, he sent it to Tom and me. We were in upstate New York, and I was making $7,000 a year teaching in a rural school and putting Tom through law school. And at the top of the page, it said, here's the job. If you come back to small town Iowa, this is the job Tom can have practicing law. Here's the job you can have as a teacher. And he invited us back, and we made that decision, and we never regretted it. But I want to make sure that every one of you can look your children and grandchildren in the eye and say, here's the job. It's a good job. It's a job that's exciting. We want you to come back to small town Iowa. And I think we should quit defining the success of our children by how far away they get away from home. And we should start investing in industrial technology education in our rural schools and making sure that we make the case to them that they don't have to go anyplace else, that they can find economic opportunity right here. And we can build those layers and layers of economic opportunity. And I pledge I'll work for you every day to do that. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming tonight. This concludes our debate. I would like to thank the candidates for coming. I would like to thank the campaigns for allowing us to host the event, and I wish both candidates the best of luck from now until November. And I hope each and every one of you have a safe drive home tonight. Thanks a lot for coming, and thanks for coming to Franklin County.
If tomorrow all the things were gone I worked for all my life.
Thank you for tuning in this Monday night. A Lesson in Liberty, the signing of the U.S. Constitution, and a debate between Steve King and Christy Vilsack, candidates for Iowa's 4th Congressional District seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, has been a special presentation of KLMJ News.